It is really great for me to be here at South by Southwest. I'm really honored. I'm honored because this is like the smartest, most creative community out there. And it's not just that. You guys have this exuberance and this willingness to experiment that excites me. And it excites me about getting you excited about government, this thing we don't think that much about. I'm also really excited to be here in Austin. I know many of you aren't from here. I kind of am. I actually took my first steps in the Hotel San Jose. Does anyone know that place down on South Congress? Back then, it was a migrant workers hotel. My family moved here. My dad was going to grad school at UT. And I didn't even know that's where I had taken my first steps until my mom told me about this. So it's become one of my favorite places. I love it. I would be going there right after this to have a beer by the pool, but I'm not. Instead, at 3:30, I'm going to go to this Cool Like You panel that a bunch of CODEs, as they're known here in Austin, Code for America Fellows, are going to be on. It's over at the AT&T Convention the AT&T Center. And then I'm going to go to City Hall, because Doug Matthews, who's sitting over there, this awesome guy who is the communications director for the city of Austin, is helping us host a party in City Hall at 6:30 tonight. We're going to get there together there. It's at 2nd and Lavaca. Beautiful building, great venue. We're going to celebrate civic coding tonight. You're all invited. Let's go do that. Oh, back, sorry. Going ahead too much. So I'm excited to be here for a lot of reasons, but mostly because Sean and Hugh are letting me talk about government technology. Hippest crowd in the world, and I'm talking about stuff that's like probably the biggest yawn to most of you. I'm going to try to make it a little bit exciting. But I feel like many of you might have looked at this and said, oh my God, it's like a talk about dentistry software or something. But, you know, thank you guys. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Hugh, for taking the leap. And thank all of you for taking that leap of faith and being here to talk about this today. I thought what I'd do is sort of tell you a little bit about why there is a growing community of people who give a damn about Coding for America, why I give a damn about it, and why I hope many of you will decide that you give a damn about this. And I'm going to sort of tell the story of Code for America and how it came about, but I'm going to start kind of at the end. I'm going to start with a story of a conversation I had just a couple of weeks ago. So my colleague Abhi Nemani and I went to talk to one of the best known and most successful accelerators out there a couple of weeks ago. Later this year, we're going to be starting our own civic accelerator. It's focused exclusively on civic startups. So that means companies that are working with government or directly with citizens to make this ecosystem better and improve government. And we've been seeking out advice and help from people who know how to run these things. Now, one of the things that this guy at the accelerator said is that they advise entrepreneurs to work on problems that they have in their own lives. But this accelerator primarily attracts sort of 25-year-old Stanford grads, basically, and they just don't have that many problems in their own lives. So what they're basically doing is they're trying to find things that they can make a little bit easier or a little bit more convenient, primarily using web and mobile apps. And I thought, wait a minute, these guys are entrepreneurs. They're starting new business. So aren't they filing paperwork with the city and the state and the county and the federal government to start these new businesses? And don't they find that to be kind of a drag? Don't they hate it when they're standing in line at the DMV? You know, they're going to grow up and they're going to buy houses and they're going to remodel them and they're going to have to file a ton of paperwork with the city. Might they want to solve problems like that? Now, of course, they don't want to fix those problems basically because it's such a drag, right? They didn't quit their corporate jobs to go work in yet another stultifying bureaucracy, and that's part of the problem here. But the other reason that they're waiting, that they're not doing this is that when they're waiting in line at the DMV or whatever, they can't see what's going on the other side of the counter. Or if they're filing something online, I guess, on the other side of the browser. So I thought I'd show you guys a little bit of what's happening on the other side of the counter when you're encountering government. Because I think that developers and designers and entrepreneurs are the kind of people that if you see something that's broken, you're going to fix it. So when you're filling out paperwork or whatever, this is what's going on the other side of the counter, okay? If it looks like it was built in the 80s or maybe 20 years ago, it's because it was. Most of these web apps are, a lot of them only run on older versions of IE. Sometimes things get broken in the software and they just don't have the resources to go fix it. So this is a drop-down menu that has nothing in it, which is probably better than a lot of these things that have like 500 things in the drop-down menu, even though only 5 of them ever get used. This is the software that that people in congressional office use to take calls from constituents and log their opinions on various issues. And it takes a really long time to figure this out. So if you wonder why they're not, you feel like government isn't listening or your politicians aren't listening, it's because their software sometimes. And this isn't even fair, because none of you are going to write software for green screens. I realize this. But, you know, the reason that people haven't upgraded this technology is probably because there isn't a better alternative. Because there aren't smart, creative, entrepreneurial people like you who see that this is a real market and want to fix it. Because you can't see it, you don't even know that it's a market, and you don't know how much American cities are spending on this stuff. Now, people tell me all the time that there's no money in government technology, and CIOs in cities will also tell you there's no money. Really? Add it up, federal, state, and local. This is a projection. We spend annually in government right now $140 billion a year on government technology. And it's projected to be $172 billion soon. So let me give you a point of comparison. How much do you think Apple pays out to all iPhone developers annually? The entire market that the developers get, $2 billion. The size of the entire video game industry domestically is a little more than $10 billion. This is not a small market. So, why is it that we're spending $140 billion and government bureaucrats have to use this crap? Because it's the last big undisrupted market, and because people like you would rather have your teeth pulled than work with government. But here's what I'm here to say, and this is what I'm going to return to time and time again in this talk. It's my refrain. Things are changing. The people who are responsible for government technology are changing. A lot of you got to meet, I think it was just a couple days ago here at South By, Todd Park. He's our new federal CTO. I hope you got a sense of the way he thinks. There's also Steve Van Roekel, who's our federal CIO, and they're leading up the technology effort in Washington. The thing that you should take away from this, if you didn't hear him a couple of days ago, these guys think like you, they share your values, and they want to work with you. There's also an amazing set of leaders at technology at the local level. John Tolva and Brett Goldstein are doing unbelievable things in the city of Chicago with data and figuring out how to optimize city services to make the city work better and to save money. They're just doing super innovative stuff. This is Nigel Jacob and Chris Osgood. They lead up an office in Boston called the Office of New Urban Mechanics. They're doing fantastic work. Right now, they came down here. They actually had to fly into San Antonio because their plane got canceled. They drove to San Antonio using a new application called Street Bump that detects potholes by just having your iPhone or your smartphone know when it's bouncing in the car. And that's just one of several great projects. I'm going to talk about some of their work later. This is Rachel Stern. She's the Chief Digital Officer for the City of New York. She's doing fantastic stuff. I think Forrest Frizzell is here. He's from the city and county of Honolulu. Jeff Friedman, done amazing things, a dynamic, charismatic leader in the city of Philadelphia. Denise Ross in New Orleans. These are the kind of people that you want to be working with, and they're doing amazing things. They're risk takers and they're leaders. But it's not just that the people building government or leading government technology are changing. It's also the people building government technology are changing. And no, I don't just mean the CFA fellows. There is a new breed of entrepreneur, people like Kevin Merritt at Socrata. He's building data platforms for cities to use. Jed Sundwall at Measured Voice. Ben Berkowitz, who probably some of you saw before at CClickFix, and the folks at CitySourced. They're just doing great things. Even something like Neighbor Goods. I don't know if any of you have heard Mickey Krimmel speak here before. Great company. You don't think of it as a civic startup, but she's working with city governments to make neighborhoods better. She's a civic entrepreneur. I love Mickey. She does great stuff. So The other thing to understand, though, is that the processes that define government technology are also changing. So procurement processes have been scaring entrepreneurs off of the government market for a really long time. I heard the other day that there's a government in Australia, it's the sort of DC of Australia, that's now outlawed procurement for anything under $100,000, which is great, right? Because that costs $100,000 to do a procurement, so it's like doubling the cost. So how many of you here think that you could build a solution that would make government better for less than $100,000, right? I think so. Thank you. There's a lot you can do at price points far lower than that. And if it's happening in Australia, it's going to start happening elsewhere. These things spread from government to government. Things are really changing. But more importantly, the will to do things differently in government is finally emerging. And it's driven by a whole bunch of different people, both inside government and outside government. They're frustrated with they're frustrated as hell with things, but they're not complaining about it. They're fixing it. And that's the important part. Now, these folks know that it is very important that we vote, but we are not going to fix what's wrong with government by electing new leaders, or at least just by electing new leaders. Too many people think that the main input to the system of voting, to the system of government, is voting. But the system is really enormous. It's sort of like you're running the most bloated piece of software out there and you think you're changing it or optimizing it by changing the font on the menus. It just doesn't make that much of a difference. We have to engage at lower levels of the system. We have to engage with the machinery of government if we're going to change this. So this community that's changing things, they're not just being politically active. They're being bureaucratically active. And sometimes that means they're working with bureaucracy, and sometimes it means they're going around it. But the key thing is they're not just talking about policy changes, they're getting stuff done. So speaking of getting things done, I've talked a little bit about our accelerator and sort of our general framework, but I haven't told you what Code for America does. So let me back up a little bit, tell you the story of Code for America. I started Code for America about 2 years ago because I got to see a little bit of what was on the other side of the counter. I've worked with geeks pretty much my entire life. Actually, before that, for 2 years, I worked in nonprofits. So one at a healthcare think tank and one for a child welfare agency. And frankly, those jobs were very frustrating and disempowering to me. So I left. I traveled around the world for a year. When I came back, I kind of accidentally landed in the middle of the video game industry. As Katie was saying, I ran GDC for a long time in the Associated Properties. I did that for 8 years, and then I ended up co-producing the Web 2.0 events. And it was doing that that led my boss and a guy that many of you know named Tim O'Reilly to decide that there was a window of opportunity opening to bring the principles and values of the web into government. So Tim and my boss Eric realized in 2008 that they could start an event for government, and it was called Gov 2.0. And it was really fantastic because I got to watch Tim go from the general idea that there was an opportunity here to defining a really fundamental framework that we could use to make this happen and make it real. And he was writing about that, and I was sort of following that and putting that out there on my Twitter stream. And we were very much focused at the federal level. But what happened is that I have a friend who's been the chief of staff for the mayor of Tucson for a very long time, and he reached out to me and he said, "Great idea, love what you're doing, perfect. But why are you focused on the feds? I want to talk to you about American cities. American cities are in a massive financial crisis. 90% of them are cutting services to their citizens. And more importantly, cities are like the unit of government that people understand, right? We know what our city does for us primarily, and if we don't, we can get educated about that, but it's pretty concrete stuff. The state and the federal level, it's just a little bit more abstract to us. And if we roll out apps in a city that actually work with city services, citizens can see those apps in action right away, and it's much more concrete. So what Andrew came to me and said is, can you get developers from the Web 2.0 world to come to Tucson and write apps for Tucson? And I was like, that's just not going to happen. No one's going to leave Silicon Valley and all the opportunities there and all the VC world that's there and go to Tucson and write apps for government. They don't know what to do. There's no money in it, and it's just not where they want to be. And then one day, we were having a beer, how many things start, and Andrew was talking about his experience having done a program that started in the 90s that many of you probably know called Teach for America. yeah, teach America. And kind of a light bulb kind of went off for me, because I said, you know what, often you can't get people to do something for money, but you can get them to do it because they think it would be a good thing to do for the world. What if we started this thing called Code for America? And that night I told my family that I was going to quit my job and start this thing, because I didn't think anyone else was going to do it. And after CFA was born, it occurred to me that those 2 years I spent in nonprofits working with government, working with social services, had served a role in my life, had served a purpose. I felt at that time that I was just enabling a really broken system. And when I started Code for America, I realized later this was me returning to that agenda. But instead of enabling a broken system, I wanted to try to find a way to help change the system itself. So in December 2009, I finished up my last Web 2.0 Expo. January 2010, a guy named Leonard Lin helped me put up a really simple web page with a form asking cities across America to apply to this program. You have to understand, this program didn't exist yet, really. I was the only full-time staff. It was completely unproven. And we did have a general promise that we were going to produce something, but we couldn't tell you exactly what it was that we were going to produce. And yet 13 cities applied to the program. So if you think that government doesn't want to do things differently, that there's no political will to take risks, to challenge yourself, I would encourage you to talk to those 13 people. It's pretty amazing. Now, of course, all those 13 of those people didn't pan out. Some of them did, and we ended up with 4 contracts with city governments, actual, real contracts that went through procurement. So I'm here to tell you, it can be done, even by small companies that are brand new. Now, we ended up working with only 3 of those cities, and at the end, I'll tell you the story of what happened to the 4th one. But those 3 cities who got us contracts that year honestly are true innovators, and they're real heroes in my book. So a special shout-out to Jeff Friedman in Philly, Nigel Jacob and Chris Osgood in the city of Boston, and Bill Schreier in Seattle. They're awesome guys, rock stars. Thank you. Thank you. I have to catch up here. These are my 3 cities. So then we put out our call for fellows. Developers and designers who were willing to take a year off, move to San Francisco, spend most of the year traveling back and forth between San Francisco and the city they were assigned to, work for a very small stipend, under difficult conditions, in an unproven program. So who would do that, right? I remember being in my kitchen the day the first application came through and came into my email, and I was there with an entrepreneur named Lane Becker, and I was sort of jumping up and down. Somebody applied. And he was like, did you think they wouldn't? Because you've done a lot of work for something you didn't seem to think was going to work. And I said, I really didn't know. I didn't know if anyone would care about this. At the end of that application process for our very first year of the program, 362 people applied to the program. And the second year, for this year, we had 550 applicants. So if you think the tech industry doesn't care about government, talk to one of those guys. So then we had our cities, and we had our fellows, and in January 2011, we had them all come together and we got started. We really didn't know what to expect the first year. The cities didn't know what to expect from the fellows. The fellows didn't know what to expect from the city context. No one really knew what to expect from us as an organization. But there was really no way through that first year except to try things, to talk a lot about what was going on, to try to measure what we could and to improve the program. We were unprepared in a lot of ways. Oh, I'm sorry. These are wonderful 2011 fellows. They're just a fantastic group of people. A bunch of them are here. Some of them are wearing their jackets. But I encourage you to reach out and talk to them about that. We've also got a bunch of our 2012 fellows here. So we were unprepared in many ways, including really basic practical stuff, like the fact that the dress code in City Hall in Boston is actually pretty conservative. It's kind of a suit and tie place. But some of the fellows we sent there didn't actually own ties. So there were tie tying lessons. And more than that, so there were 6 guys on the Boston team, and poor Carla Macedo, who's a total hero, one woman. By the way, our gender balance is a lot better this year. But amongst those 6 guys, it turns out they had between them 6 ties. So it didn't look like they were wearing the same tie every day, they would apparently pass them around. And then there was Max Ogden, who just stopped bothering because you couldn't tell he was wearing the tie under his beard. And there were a lot of other lessons that we learned that year. Things like the fact that when you want to pay for Amazon Web Services, but the city doesn't have a credit card and Amazon won't take a purchase order, what do? Or how do you get somebody in the city to release the data that you need for your application? Or how do you apply Eric Ries's lean startup methodology inside of a big bureaucracy? So, in the end, what did we actually accomplish that first year? Well, I want to be clear, it's not just about the apps, but collectively the fellows produced 21 apps that year. It's pretty amazing. And I wish I could talk about every single one of those apps, and I wish I could talk about every single one of those amazing fellows that spent the year with us. It was quite an experience. They're really my heroes. But I'm going to just talk about two of them now, two that illustrate sort of different points about what Code for America is about. So the first one wasn't at all on our radar at the beginning of the year. It got on our radar because the Boston Globe wrote an article about how frustrated parents in Boston were about the school selection process. They did not know which schools their kids were eligible for, and more importantly, which would be the right school for their kids. And the way they were asked to figure that out was to read this 28-page printed brochure. And you can read this entire 28-page brochure and still have no idea which schools you are eligible for. And so after the Boston Globe wrote this article, the mayor reached out to Chris and Nigel and New Urban Mechanics, and they went to the team. And a team of fellows led by a guy named Joel Mahoney and two others worked on an application that ends up looking like this. It's called discoverbps.org. You can input your address, the age of your child, if your child has a sibling at a school, and it returns this, just telling you basically, here are the schools that you're eligible for. You can favorite a couple, read a little bit more about them, and compare them. So it basically does what a modern web app should do. Now here's the thing about this app. Joel worked on it full-time. The other two were working on it part-time while they were working on other projects. They started it in August and pushed it live to the web in October, about 2.5 months. We were told that if this had gone through regular government channels, it would have taken about 2 years and cost about $2 million. So the money is important here. I talked before about the fiscal crisis that our cities are in. There's no reason we should be paying orders of magnitude more for a web app than it should really cost. But the timeliness issue is just as important here. Like, how are we supposed to have trust in our government if our mayors can't fix problems like this in less than 2 years? I mean, those parents weren't going to be helped by this thing coming up 2 years later. But there's one thing that's even more important to me than the cost and the timeliness issues, and that's how this app looks and feels and how it works. Let me explain a little. When we got the fellows together that first day in January where they came to the office, we sat down with them in small groups and we said to them, why are you here? I mean, it's sort of insane, right? That you could be making so much money somewhere else. You could be doing something that's a lot easier. Why did you come here to this program? And I got so many answers to that question that were just things I hadn't really anticipated when I thought about the program. But one of them struck me in particular. One of the fellows named Scott Silverman looked at me and he said, I'm here because I believe that interfaces to government can be simple, beautiful, and easy to use. And it kind of knocked me over. Because no, even doing Code for America, no one had ever said that to me before. And I felt like it was an idea that kind of came into its realm of possibility just by him saying it. He really cares about this. And when I look at Discover BPS, that's what I see, an app that's simple, beautiful, and easy to use. Now, the second app that I want to tell you about is an artifact of the fellows being in Boston during February. Let's see if we've got that. They were there last February. It happened to snow an enormous amount. Do you remember it was called Snowpocalypse? So one of the things that the fellows saw was that the plows are plowing down the street. They're pushing snow to the side. And fire hydrants get covered in snow, sometimes much worse than this, 5-6 feet high. And fire hydrants can't do their job of fighting fires until they're dug out. And the city doesn't get around to doing this. They are struggling just to clear the streets. So one of the fellows, a guy named Eric Michaels Ober, noticed something in particular, and that's that people are shoveling sidewalks right in front of these hydrants, right? Now, he did what any good developer would do. He wrote a little app. It's called Adopt a Hydrant. You agree to adopt a hydrant and dig it out when it snows. If you don't do your job, someone can steal it from you. If you do consistently dig it out, you get to name it. His was named Al. And they're actually advertising these with cute little posters around Boston that say, "Call me Al." So it's sort of a modest little app. It may be the smallest of the 21 apps that the fellows wrote last year, but it's doing something that very few other government technologies do, and that's spreading organically. So you all know the procurement process. This isn't going through the procurement process. It's open source. Any of you can go to it. It's at github.com/codeforamerica. Look for Adopta. Now, the first person who saw it was this awesome guy in Honolulu. And he came to us and said, "I found this app on your GitHub account, and I want to use it in Honolulu." And we were like, "Okay, Forrest." And he said, "No, I know we don't have snow, but what we have are these tsunami sirens on the beach. And people steal the batteries out of the tsunami sirens. Now, it's very important that the tsunami sirens work when they're needed. But again, the city doesn't have the resources to go check on them all the time. So he's standing up Adopt a Hydrant as Adopt a Siren. And now it's not just going to be in the city of Honolulu. It's going to be statewide, we hope, in Hawaii. And then someone else heard about it in Seattle, and they're going to use it to get citizens to clear out clogged storm drains when they get filled up. How hard is that to do, just to clear that out? And actually, they've already rolled it out in Chicago to get citizens to agree to shovel out sidewalks. And in fact, believe it or not, that is one of our fellows from 2012, Ben Sheldon, and the sidewalk he is shoveling belongs to John Tolva, the CTO of Chicago. So I guess they're making friends around there. So the thing about Adopt a Hydrant is that this app, I think, invites us to think about government a little bit differently. Government is an institution that's not really at the center of this app. I mean, we did get hired by Boston to write it in the first place, and we did need the GPS data. We needed the locations of the fire hydrants to roll out that first app. But it's not an app that calls on government services. It calls on us, right? So the institution of government is sort of at the margins, but the idea of government is right at the center of this app. And that idea is the following. So when we can get rid, if we can, of all of that emotional baggage that we carry about the notion of government, whether it's the divisive politics or the line at the DMV or, for me right now, the fact that I'm finding it very difficult to get my daughter's passport renewed, if you can get those things out of your mind for a minute and think about it, at its core, government is what we do together. That's it. And this app invites us to think about government not as the platform, not as the problem of an ossified institution, but simply as a problem of collective action, which is fantastic because we're getting pretty good at enabling collective action through technology. Now, instead of talking about the 18 other apps that came out of last year, which I would love to do, I'm going to return to this notion that it's not just the apps. It's about showing what's possible. It's about creating political will for change. It's about doing things differently. It's about creating a demand for better, faster, cheaper. It's also about what Mark Head calls the CFA effect. So he defines that as the ability to highlight what's truly possible when government data is open and usable by developers. Now, he saw this in action at a hackathon that our Philadelphia team did last year. When all the demos for the projects were done, the people in city government were walking around. They were kind of astounded. The unanimous sentiment was, wow, all this got done in one day? And there's another angle to the CFA effect that Jeff Friedman, our fantastic champion in the city of Philadelphia, has talked about. He told us that the CFA fellows were like mysterious strangers who came in and taught the city staff that they had the magic in them all along. Very sweet. So sometimes that means breaking down silos, getting people to talk to each other who don't normally. And sometimes it's about just having this basic awareness of what the digital realm can do. A guy named Tom Steinberg, who runs My Society in the UK, they do fantastic civic apps. He wrote this recently on a blog. What good governance and good society look like are now inextricably linked to the digital. And I think that's true, which is why I get very excited when I see things like this. This is one of our fellows this year, Jessica Lord. She is teaching the mayor of Macon, Georgia, how to use Google Docs. So this happened at an event that we held on February 25th. It was called Code Across America. 16 cities participated by having events that brought developers and designers and city people together and standing up civic apps in their communities. And I got to tell you, the mayors of these cities showed up in Philadelphia, in Macon, in Santa Cruz, the mayors at hackathons. That's great. So my friend and the author of The Information Diet, a book you should all read, Clay Johnson, said this to our fellows earlier. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Mayor Nutter. Coding isn't just about making software. It's about rewiring society. Now, Clay is making this point to get more of you excited about this. And that's never been more true now. And again, I want to return to that refrain, things are changing. Technology is making it possible for us to fundamentally reframe the function of government. And I'm going to explain that particular point with a story about the new mascot, I think, of the Gov2.0 movement, the possum. You're going to hear a lot about possums. So I'll explain. This is the 311 call center in Boston. So it's the city's services and information line, I think. But most cities now have 311, some don't. But if you have an issue or a question, you call 311 and you get the call center. We have our fellows spend a day on that call center as part of their training, so they get to understand how city government works. And if you ever get a chance to do that, and I strongly suggest you do, you'll find out, as Scott did here, that people call government with a pretty wide range of issues, including having a possum stuck in your house. So Scott got this call, and he typed possum into the official knowledge base where he's supposed to look up the answer. He didn't find anything under possum. He started typing animal control, and he's looking at about how you can send the animal control people out. And he finally said, you know what, can you just open all the doors and turn on the music really loud and see if the possum leaves? And it worked. But that's not the end of the possums. So Boston doesn't just have a call center. They also have an app. It's a web and mobile app. We didn't write it. Chris and Nigel in New Urban Mechanics were responsible for this app. It's a great app. And people report possums on there, too. So one day, this report came in on Citizens Connect. Possum in my trash can. Can't tell if it's dead. How do I get this removed? So whereas Scott was speaking person to person, this is public. This is different. Anybody can see these reports. And in this case, someone did see it, a neighbor. And the next reply came under that report that said, walked over there, found the trash can behind the house. Possum check, living yep, turned the trash can on its side, walked home. Good night, sweet possum. So it's a great story. And it's more than a great story. It illustrates a couple things. It illustrates the physical meeting the digital. It illustrates government getting in on crowdsourcing. Most importantly for me, it illustrates Tim O'Reilly's concept of government as a platform. It's a platform for people helping themselves and helping each other. Now, one citizen helped another here, but government played a key role. Government connected them. And government could have connected them to government services if they were needed, but they weren't here. Because a neighbor helping a neighbor is so much better alternative. It's a better and cheaper alternative to government services. When neighbors help each other, we strengthen our communities. We call animal care, it just costs a lot of money. So we can reframe the function of government in a way that actually scales if we architect our systems correctly. But if we want that government, And we should, because the alternative isn't very pretty. If we want that government, we're going to have to do two things. We're going to have to expect different things from government, and we're going to have to expect different things from ourselves. We're going to have to remember that we're not just consumers, and we're not just consumers of government, paying taxes and getting back services. We're citizens. And citizens don't just complain, they fix things. They shovel out fire hydrants. They turn over trash cans when there's possums in them. And the biggest thing that we learned this year in Code for America, over everything else, is that we're not going to fix government unless we also fix citizenship. And by the way, if citizen is one opposite of consumer, the other opposite is maker. And I am really happy, sorry guys, I'm really happy that there is a big presence for the maker community here at South by Southwest, because when I look around, I think that this is really the sister movement to the Gov2O movement. And when I see our fellows and their partners in City Hall, what I see them doing is just getting down to the business of making things. And that makes me super happy. So I'm going to call on everyone here to act like a citizen. And once again, I'm going to return to that mantra. Things are changing. Until recently, if you wanted to code for America, you probably had to take a year off. And it's actually a pretty big sacrifice. But now I'm going to tell you seven ways that you can help fix government. And some of them are big asks, but a lot of them are really small asks. So let me start there. Now, the first way that's a pretty big ask is to go into public service. Now, certainly, it's a lot to ask, but it's also a really big opportunity. I told you a little bit about Todd Park and Steve Van Roekel, and if these guys are hiring, I think that would be an amazing place to work, an amazing experience. There are also federal agencies like the CFPB and the FCC that are creating really unique environments for developers. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a new federal agency, and they have explicitly stated that they are intentionally trying to see what happens when you make a federal agency work like a startup. I think that could be really cool. It's going to be hard, but I think that could be really cool. I think it would be a great place to be. And all the city leaders I've mentioned before are doing the same thing. They're creating wonderful opportunities for you guys to work in public service. Now, you can partner with one of these people who's already leading an innovation effort, but there's also a lot of places in government where there isn't somebody already doing that, and that's going to be more difficult. That might be your own city, your own town might need somebody in technology. If there isn't someone already there leading an innovation effort, it is going to be harder, and you may have a tough time getting it off the ground if there's not that much internal support. But for any of you who would ever consider taking a job like that, I want to tell you that there's going to be an enormous amount of support from the outside. There's a network of these innovation leaders in government now, and I'll tell you, if you're fighting the good fight, they are on your side. They have your back. And it's important change. Now, the other thing you need to know if you're thinking about public service is some demographic stuff. Back in the 1970s, government grew a lot, and they hired a lot of young people. And so in 1970, 70% of local government employees were under the age of 40. It was a very young workforce. Most of those people have stayed in government. And as of 2006, and I'm sorry I don't have a more accurate, more up-to-date statistics, only 13% of local government employees are under 40. Now, in the city and county of San Francisco, that means that 60% of local government employees are eligible to retire by 2015. So that's basically in 2 years. This is a little bit old. So local government's going to go from looking like that to looking like this. There is an enormous opportunity for people to move into public service and to create a new culture of innovation and do things differently. The second way that I would encourage you, and this is a little bit obvious, I'm sorry, to Code for America is to apply to a fellowship. Our applications are open right now. We have an early decision period. And if you want to be considered an early, you actually have to apply by end of this week. But don't worry about that. If you don't mind getting an answer until October, you have until the end of July to apply. It is an amazing experience. You'll learn a lot about the world. You'll learn a lot about yourselves. You'll get a lot of support and a lot of attention. You'll have an amazing, fun time. But most importantly, you'll be doing something that really matters. The third way that you can Code for America or Help Government, and I talked about this earlier, is to build a civic startup. I think I kind of made my case here. There is an enormous amount of money to be made while working on making our government better. But I want to return to that $140 billion market that will soon be $172. That number is way too big. Let me tell you a story I heard from a guy who is running Mozilla's accelerator. Now, before he was at Mozilla, and he was in a different role, he was on a team of VCs that were being pitched startup after startup. And every startup kept coming into the room and saying, we're going to tackle a $1 billion market. Our market is $1 billion. And I think he got a little bit tired of hearing that. And then a company came in, it happened to be called MySQL, and they said, we're going into a $4 billion market, and we're going to cut it in half, and we're going to take half of that, and that's our $1 billion market. That's what I want this accelerator to do, and I want you guys to do it. I want you to cut that $140 billion market in half, but still make better software. I don't think that's that hard to do. We just have to get at it. So, an easier way that you guys can get involved with this is just go to your city and ask them to be involved with Code for America. If you think this is a program that would make your city better, help them understand how to better leverage technology, we are looking for cities to apply. The deadline for cities to apply is actually the end of this month. The way to do this really is to go to your city council person, your alderman, maybe somebody you know in the mayor's office. You can even go to like a block watch captain, but anybody in city government that you can hook us up with is helpful. This is how they get to apply. It's someone from this network of leaders, and it's someone from regular citizens going and saying, I need you guys to do this to get your city working better. Now, the fifth way is really about making government data more valuable. At the federal level, at the state and the local level, public servants are working very hard to make government data available to the technical community. And they're spending a lot of political capital to do that because not everybody understands the value of this thing. You guys need to do your part. When there are apps contests, if there are challenges, data visualization, data analysis challenges that the government people put out, it's your job to show up, to rise to the occasion and make something of that. Let's show everybody what we can do with this data. You can do this in your spare time, you can do this at a weekend hackathon, you can do this as part of an apps contest, but follow people like Todd Park and Steve Van Roekel and all the local innovators that I mentioned, because when they put those calls out, we really need to answer them. Now, the sixth way that you can make your government better with technology is what we're announcing here today at South by Southwest. It's called the Code for America Brigade. And when you hear that word brigade, you should think about the volunteer fire brigade, but the digital version of it. How can you, in your own community, make your community better with technology? So you shouldn't have to take a year off. If you go to Code for America, brigade.codeforamerica.org, you'll be able to say, I want to start hacking in wherever you live, and we'll hook you up with other people who want to do the same thing in your community. And more importantly, we'll hook you up with apps that other people have already started. You don't need to start with the first line of code when you're writing civic apps. There's a ton of work that's already happened here, and you can leverage their work. Build a brigade. If there isn't one already in your city, start a brigade. This is how these movements happen, and we're trying to catalyze it. A couple people who are not here in this room, they happen to be over at the AT&T Center right now. Kevin Curry and Jack Maddens have worked their butts off on this over the past couple of months. If you see them around, please talk to them about the brigade and tell them what you would like it to do for your community. And the rest of our staff has really worked hard on this. So if all of those things are still too much for you and you're just not able to stand up for your country in that way, how about just the tiniest little ways? How about we just live like citizens and act like citizens? How about we turn over those garbage cans? How about we just pull weeds when you're in your public park? There's a million ways that you can represent just by doing little things. And it could be through the apps. It could be that you sign up for Adopta whatever in your city and you use that app. But don't let the app be an excuse. You don't need an app to remind you to pick up garbage on your street, for instance. Now, I often spend the summers in a really small town in Oklahoma called Tishomingo. It's population 3,000. And the guy that I stay with there, a very close friend of our family, happens to be the mayor of that town. So I've gotten to know what it's like to be the mayor of a small town, and it's really not what you think. He's constantly on his cell phone dealing with things like the neighbor's dog that got out or an errant garbage can or something like that. And when the sun goes down at the end of the day in Chichimango, Mayor Park Hill always takes a walk, and I take a walk with him. And he's got with him a trash bag. And as we walk, we pick up garbage off the street. And we also weed. We pull out this Johnson grass. It's a beautiful sort of feather grass, but it's invasive. And that's what he does every single night in his community. And if we all did things like that, if we all just weeded and picked up garbage, our communities would be such a much better place. That's the notion of citizenship I think we need to bring back. So what I'm trying to say here is that this is really the opportunity of this moment. We have built an amazing consumer internet. We can do things so much more socially, more connectedly, more conveniently than we ever could before. But what we need to do now is build the citizen internet. There's never been another time in history when the leaders in government, and I don't mean the politicians, I mean the people who are actually getting shit done, when those people have not only wanted your input, but are asking for your help. When many people think about service to their country, they think about being in the military. And if there are veterans or people currently serving in this room, I think we should all applaud you. That's one way to serve your country. If you have programming skills, data skills, design skills, that's another way to serve your country, and your country needs you. Now, we're obviously not fighting a foreign war here, but we are fighting something, and it's important. We're fighting the slow crumbling of our will to do things together and to create the society that we want to live in. And if we're going to raise an army to fight this battle, it's going to be a geek army. So if you don't need to put your life on the line to do this, but it can be incredibly frustrating. It's difficult to work with bureaucracies. It's even more difficult to work inside them. You know, the Peace Corps sells itself as the toughest job you'll ever love, but that's because sometimes the hardest things are the ones that bring us the most meaning in our lives. 19 fellows finished the program last year. And some of them faced really huge challenges. I talked a little bit about how one of the teams, we didn't end up working with the last city. That's because the team that was supposed to be working with the District of Columbia, they got kicked out their very first day in D.C., literally kicked out on the street. And it wasn't because of anything they'd done. It was just that the mayor had changed and the new mayor didn't want them there. Now, all of the teams faced a lot of obstacles, setbacks, difficulties. None of the other ones gladly were actually kicked out of their city. But they all had huge challenges. And yet, each of the 19 fellows that finished the program said to us that if they could go back to the beginning of the year and start over, they'd still do it again. And each of them said that it changed their lives for the better. Now, Code for America is nonpartisan and it's nonpolitical. So don't misread me when I quote from two politicians here. Howard Dean said, "You have the power." Obama said, "Yes, we can." They were both right. They just weren't specific enough. I just told you 7 things that you can do for your country. Now, that's 7 ways that you can act like a citizen or act like a citizen coder. When I was a kid, it was all about this guy, Smokey the Bear. Only you can prevent forest fires. And I really believed him. It's still true, by the way. Careful with those fires in the forest. But it's also true that only you can change government. It's not you alone, it's you and others. You have to decide that you want to do something about it. First, you have to decide that it's worth fixing. First, you have to look at the world we live in and all the huge challenges that we face. And you have to ask yourself honestly, can we do this without fixing the one institution that's designed to represent us all? And you think it's worth doing, let's just get moving. Let's do it. Thank you very much. you. So I can take questions. There's a mic right there. I did ask for questions on the blog, so I wanted to answer some of those first for those kind people who actually wrote in. First of all, there were about seven questions about taking the Code for America model to other countries. We had people writing in from the UK, Australia, Germany. And the answer to the question, how do I get Code for America in my country, is I don't really know yet. We are going to be working on a model. We're thinking about leveraging Teach for America. Teach for America has an organization called Teach for All that coordinates the international versions of Teach for America everywhere. And we're going to try to learn from that. If you're from another country and you're interested about Code for America in your country, there's a guy up front here somewhere named Abhi Namani. Where are you, Abhi? Right there. And you can talk to him. He's in charge of our international strategy. I'll take a question from the audience now, and then I'll go back to these. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Eddie Stover. I work in advertising at Team One in Los Angeles. And I've done a little bit of freelance work for Open.gov and the Department of Defense in trying to expose as much data that's out there to do really cool things in the tech industry. I found in New England, where I grew up, in California, where I live now, that the approach to talk to city governments and national governments is very, very different depending on location and the people that are there. And there isn't as much of a unified way to get into contact with the right people as I wish there was. I don't know if you had some advice on stuff that you feel works the best, because I find emails don't go anywhere. It's all about who you know. If you could just speak to that a little bit, appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, so the question is about getting data out when it's held by somebody in government who doesn't necessarily believe it should be open to the public. I don't think there's a silver bullet there. It's a difficult process. I'd point you to a couple of resources. We have a wiki about open data and how to do it and some strategies. Certainly, there's a strategy that says that you simply say, look, this is public assets. Make it open. It's required. That will somewhat work and somewhat alienate people. We found that one thing that really works to get data available, if you can do it, but this was a little bit easier for us to do because we were inside the bureaucracy, we're inside the government at City Hall, is to tell the people in power that you're going to make that data useful to them in some way. So I'll tell you a quick story about the team in Boston. They were trying to get data about students, and one of the data sets they wanted was the real-time location data of the school buses. It was for a data platform that they were doing. And they were told over and over again that they couldn't have that data. And then one day it snowed. I told you before, they were there when it was snowing an enormous amount. And they happened to be in the call center for the Boston Public Schools. And with the school buses stuck in snow, every parent in Boston was calling and saying, where is my kid? And the people on the call center, of course, are looking at a screen that's showing the real-time location, looking up which bus their kid is on and telling them where it is. And the fellow said, you know, we could write you an app that just publishes that, and the parents could find that information out on their own, and you won't get as many phone calls. And then they got the data. Sometimes I think you really have to, I mean, it is important to push, and I think it's a perfectly valid standpoint to have that this stuff should be public, that it's paid for with taxpayer dollars, but you got to work the carrot and the stick. You've got to show people why making this data open will make it valuable. And that's part of what we're trying to do with the Brigade. I mean, if you can go to your city government and say, I need the data set of public art in our city because I'm going to create an app that lets people take a walking tour of the art in our city. That's something they can immediately see the value of, and then they'll understand what would be going on with the other data sets.
Thank you. Great panel.
Thanks.
Okay, my name is Ayn. I come from a small European country of Estonia, also known as a country of Skype. We have had digital government for years, electronic elections and so on, but it's all based on a secure infrastructure. So we all carry smart ID cards, and we can authenticate ourselves to the government, and more importantly, we can sign digital documents. So by law, the government has to accept digitally signed documents. How do we solve this authentication digital signature problem in this country?
I don't know. But I think that a lot of the apps that we're talking about don't require signatures. That's a bigger problem. That's sort of an e-government problem. And I think there's going to be smart people that want to solve that. We're not those people. We're going to find new innovative solutions that sort of change the game. But we, as particularly with Code for America, we don't really do anything that has to do with voting. Our point really is that the political process is one thing, and there are an enormous number of talented people who are working on that. PopVox is a great one. VoteIsIn, and I mean, these are more about, you know, how to vote, you know, who to vote for than actually the mechanisms of voting. A lot of people are working on that. Not a lot of people are working, again, at the bureaucratic level, at the operational level, how to make cities just run better. And that's just sort of our focus. I'm sorry I don't have much of an answer for you.
Thank you.
This is going to be the last question.
Hi, Elizabeth Maritz. I'm from St. Louis, and actually my first job out of college was working for a first responder tool that helped track crimes, and so I was really feeling a lot of what you're saying up there. One of the big issues that we ran into was hardware limitations. So I was just curious to know if on any of the projects that you worked on, if it demanded updated hardware and how you addressed some of those issues.
Yeah, we haven't really run into those issues of new hardware. It's certainly true that government tends to issue older hardware. My friend Clay was asked to work in government. Clay Johnson, who wrote Information Diet, was asked to work in government, and he said, "I'll take the job if you can buy me a Mac." And I said, "It's never going to happen." I think there's a lot you can do with really simple technology. If you look at Adopt a Hydrant, it doesn't, you know, something like that. It can run on anything. I think if we can pioneer a new model that's more lightweight, that's simpler, but does important things, eventually that money can get spent on better hardware instead of really expensive, outdated enterprise systems that haven't been updated for a long time. But it's probably something that'll just happen in time. And I think that's it. Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
matter how many people they hire, they can only do so much. And we're trying to do, we are trying to do so much this year. I think they'll always have a role. I mean, but in particular.
No, it can be across the board. The regular firearms, things like that. That by and large is just brand advertisers. It's what after within the audience, and the reason for that is they will put together lazy portion of the ad system. It's water running down the hill. They take the path of least resistance. They put an RFP together. Of that RFP, of that particular buy, which was already kind of created through the creative process, the creative portion of the ad agency, the actual media buyers will then assemble that, put that into an RFP, and put it out into the various networks and people buying. The repurposing of ad units. So they've already spent a ton of money on their broadcast ads, right? So this is a video unit that has gone into broadcast, that's gone into cable. So if you can comes in that rich media component and put it in of that respect might be applied to mobile. And if you get that 10% of that, so I think we can probably get started now that they've turned on the microphones.
All right.
So you guys didn't have much of a trouble finding the place after we last minute found out that we're now in a church. So my name's Archie. I'm a recovering music executive. Okay. So thanks for coming, firstly. We're gonna have a pretty just open, fluid discussion. I have a great set of panelists that have agreed. Thank you for participating. And we're really going to talk about best practices within mobile and music. And there's a number of things that that touches on. I'm Archie O'Connor, and I represent InMobi, which is the largest independent global ad network. We're number two behind Google overall. And I'll talk and wax a little bit about ad-supported monetization and how the ad-supported strata works within mobile and music and how it just works in general. And then my panelists, and I'll make introductions here in a moment, will go through their respective things, and we'll just kind of talk openly and have a pretty clear conversation about what we think the state of the union is with mobile and music, where we think, you know, our own prophetic and prescient sense of where we think things are going to go in the immediate and near term. Barriers that we've all experienced in terms of the growth and the promises of what mobile should be delivering, best practices, things that we think work really well, some examples given around that, and then hopefully, if all goes well, we'll be able to open this up to some Q&A for about 15 minutes or so and talk through it. So starting off to my right, we have John Bolton, who's head of product for Move Music. And John, if you want to kind of give a little background in terms of what you're doing. Move Music is, I think now you're officially the largest in North America anywhere, close to.
We're about 500,000 subscribers right now. We launched a year ago, but second largest subscription service in the United States. Rhapsody is still number one. I think they're about 1 million right now. But Move is a unique model. We've taken a very different approach to some of the basic things. The product is first is a rate plan. We took unlimited music, unlimited song downloads, ringtones, and integrated that into a voice and data rate plan. So we partner with Cricket Communications, which is a prepaid wireless carrier in the United States. And so, you for one flat rate. In fact, their most popular offer right now is $65 a month. You get unlimited voice, unlimited messaging, unlimited data, and unlimited music nationwide, flat rate. So that's a very unique approach there. The second thing that's unique is the experience on the phone. We built this music service from the ground up, and we built it for the mobile phone, not the computer. You don't need cords, syncing, clouds, all those things that we're used to with digital music services do not apply to Move Music. All you need is this. And, you know, the other thing that's unique is we actually made this for a unique customer. We made this for a customer segment that doesn't always have a computer or has limited access to a computer and doesn't always have a credit card. And so Move Music with the rate plan integration and made for the phone solves those problems for that specific customer segment. So that's the quick minute on Move.
Thank you. And then we have Bobby Rosenblum. Bobby is a shareholder and runs the entertainment group for Greenberg and Traurig. I can speak from firsthand experience that Bobby probably more than anyone I can know of in North America has knows where all the bodies are specific to deals with digital music, very, very knowledgeable around fractured copyright issues, digital distribution issues, how all the deal structures are worked with the labels and the copyright holders. So, Bobby, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Sure. Well, that was certainly appreciate the introduction. No, so I'm with the law firm Greenberg Traurig. I'm based in Atlanta, and our group, although we our entertainment practice represents artists and songwriters and producers and other talent. The bulk of what I do is representing digital media companies, and we, aside from working with Cricket and Move Music, John's company, and many years ago working with a company that Archie was with, we work with probably most of the digital music companies that you're familiar with in the U.S. and many abroad as well. So the majority of what I do is representing companies in connection with their license agreements with the major record companies, with music publishing companies, with indie labels, with the collectives, the PROs, etc. And, you know, obviously these days it's a quite interesting space to be in.
Okay. And then down the hall we have Aaron Ray. Aaron is a partner at the Collective, and Aaron, I don't have the full roster. I know that you work with Linkin Park and Enrique Iglesias and a handful of other. Collective is certainly a leading management company, artist management company based in Los Angeles. So I'll let you give more detail about you and your background.
Yeah, so we represent Alanis Morissette, Counting Crows, Slash, Stained, Big Boy. We just made a big leap into electronic dance music, some festivals there. So, you know, we have a pretty big footprint in music and every way. But we also have a pretty substantial business in video, and we're building a studio for use primarily with YouTube. Represent and partner with 8 of the top 12 channels on there and push out over a quarter billion views a month, and that's growing. So there's about 70 of us. We also represent writers, directors, actors, and so we're a traditional management company, but we like to think of ourselves as a 21st century company. A lot of our clients come to us when they're coming to the end of their deals, or they pick up the paper and see the iPad 3 is coming, or if Facebook's having an IPO and holy crap, the world's passing me by, what do I do? No longer is it practical to have the one guy who was the bad drummer be your manager and try to, you know, the world and mobile, international and mobile, are clearly where things are going. And so I spend most of my time running and developing the digital assets for all of our clients. And some bands like Linkin Park have the largest Facebook communities with 40 million plus for a band, largest YouTube subscribers, et cetera, et cetera. So we're always trying to stay ahead of the curve on the technology side and try to anticipate where our hurdles are going to be with the record labels.
Great. And then last but not least, Mr. Jeff Roberto. He is the Director of Consumer Marketing for Shazam. I think most of us know who Shazam is, but Shazam was certainly early on and ended up becoming a dominant utility and enabler for music and mobile. So I'll let you introduce him further, Jeff.
Sure. Thanks for having me. So real quick on Shazam, in terms of where we are today, I'm assuming here everyone knows who we are. We have about 180 million users globally now, and we're adding about 1.5 million a week. Top 10 most downloaded app on iTunes. And the amazing news is about 8% of folks who tag a song with Shazam go on to purchase that. So we're really driving a lot of transactions and revenue for the music industry. So, of course, labels and the industry love us for that, and we're working very closely with them on a variety of promotions and opportunities. So what I specifically do is I reach out to labels, to TV shows, networks. We're doing a lot with TV now and working to get the Shazam brand and our call to action specifically in music videos, in TV shows, in commercials, to drive people to tag that content. So we have a database currently of about 15 million songs, and we're building a database now for TV content and working directly with a lot of the major TV networks and shows. The other part of the business is with major brands. So we're also working with a lot of major brands out there that we all know and love that are advertising on TV, and building that second screen experience for them, so that when you're watching a commercial, if you like the product and want to know more, you can essentially bookmark it or check in, whichever term you prefer, and get more information about that product, either at that moment or at a later point in time.
Great. So I'm going to start the discussion off, and Bobby and I were down in the lobby catching up briefly, and I was talking about what a great day it would be if somebody could come in who was a music enabler or wanted to be a music service provider and actually created a really disruptive, innovative experience for the consumer. Could they come to a central repository and get all their clearances for a global community? Because mobile is very much global. And I'm not just saying that as a cliche phrase. If you want to look at the desktop PC, penetration was about over a 17-year process is what brought us today. About 1 billion connected devices. The monetization of that largely took place in the Western Hemisphere, largely took place in North America and Europe specifically. That is not the case with mobile. Roughly 80 cents on the dollar that's coming in is outside of North America and Europe. It's taking place all over the globe. In many cases, the developing, what we would call developing and what we would call emerging marketplaces, are an actually much more sophisticated consumer in terms of adoption, in terms of being able to transact on a mobile device. And music being ubiquitous in all cultures and music being a common language within all cultures, you would think that would be a great way to discover and deliver the promise of mobile, being able to reach a global audience. From an artist's perspective, it certainly condenses the means of distribution and the value chain. It gives greater control over the person, the artist who's actually creating, ends up actually being a better consumer experience overall. So why are we unable to go to a central place? I'm posing this question to Bobby, and then we can open it up to the group. Why are we unable to go into a central place and say, hey, I want to push your music out to this big, broad audience. I'm gonna exponentially grow your consumer footprint. Just give me the right to be able to distribute and sell your music.
For one, because then I would be out of business. No, I mean, the reality is that if you had to do a case study on how to create the most difficult licensing process involving rights, involving new business models and platforms that you could possibly imagine, and then someone presented to you the music industry today, you wouldn't believe it because it was so far-fetched. It just couldn't be true. And unfortunately, that's really the way that a lot of the companies that come to us initially to launch and potentially innovate around new business models, how they feel. They, you know, often you people will come in bright-eyed and have some amazing new ideas that have never been done before, and then gradually, as we talk with them about the issues associated with licensing, they'll realize why it has never been done before. And the challenge with music is that the licensing processes for music were created. I think there are several things, and I think it will be interesting to some of you here, depending on what your background is and what areas you focus in. But the problem is that the music industry was created in a day that never contemplated and was not designed to contemplate the types of rights clearance structures that are needed for today's digital ecosystem. And one of the greatest challenges, I think, is the lack of trust between talent and music companies, whether it's music publishers or record companies. And what's happened is that the world has been created such that artists and songwriters try to retain as many rights as they possibly can in terms of approvals, in terms of reversions, in terms whatever it may be in the particular area, whether it's sound recording or publishing rights. And as a result, there are cases, for example, with sync licensing when it comes to YouTube, where neither the labels nor publishers are technically allowed to even grant rights that they may want to grant to monetize if they could. The other problem is that, you know, you have today reemerging, for various reasons we won't get into on this panel, that's actually across the street, the 360 business model, where the labels are now once again trying to get their hands on all aspects of the artist's economic potential. And historically, over the past 20 years or so, 20, 30 years, that model has not existed. And the reason for that is that artist lawyers, managers have been sophisticated and will not grant one company all of these rights. So as a result, you have a decentralized ecosystem, basically, where you have sound recording rights that are the province of the labels. You have typical music publishing rights like mechanical and sync rights that are the province of the music publishers. You have performance rights on the publishing side that are administered by a collective, in some cases exclusively in many countries. So in order to exploit any sort of music for a lot of these new business models that we'll all be talking about, there's really no one-stop shop. And the problem is that each one of these entities, the labels, the publishers, the collectives, all and not to be confused with Aaron's company, but they all have their interest in preserving their own business. And they want to make sure that everything that is done involves them to the greatest extent possible. And that's true within individual countries, and then it's true across geographic boundaries, such that if you're looking especially to license music publishing rights, every country has its own structure, its own rate system, its own bodies that you need to deal with in order to acquire rights. So moving your business from the United States to Canada involves a completely different set of negotiations on the publishing side. So the reality is that, to Archie's question, there is no one-stop shop. I don't think in our lifetime we will see a one-stop shop. And it certainly has affected the types of business models that are possible. And in fact, what it's done is it's caused, in many cases, the legal tail to wag the business dog. And so basically, you can only get rights for certain types of things, and so you can only do certain types of things.
Right. And Aaron, I mean, obviously, when you get to a scale of Linkin Park, and you have many successful artists in your roster, I think you have the ability to argue the labels are obsolete in some capacity, right? When you get to that level where you as an artist have kind of a vista view and the ability to distribute, and I think that Bobby raising the point of 360 deals, that was obviously a pivot, or at least in my lens, it was a pivot from the label because they were fighting off obsolescence, the means of distribution, the means of reaching your consumers directly. Obviously, the lifeblood of artists has always been touring and ticket sales and merchandising. As the war on piracy, which I think is a silly war to be fighting. I mean, four to 10 trillion downloads a year are being done illegally. Roughly 4 billion are being done legally. So you can do the math. Clearly, consumer adoption of a pirated thing, as of a pirated piece of music, is the way that people are still consuming music. So when you have that, why would you then not go out and do your own deals, circumvent all of this spider's nest that Bobby just articulated, and have your own control of your own ecosystem and your direct relationship with the consumer?
The short answer is we do, except for the ones that are in contractual obligations still. And the state of California, in a very loose way, you can only be in a contract for 7 years. But it's oftentimes how many albums and album cycles and there's whatever. But you're going to start seeing many, many, many artists of platinum nature coming off of their deals. And they're going to be presented with, you know, either a much more a parsed down deal from what they're used to, and giving up more of what was discussed earlier in the 360 deal from a company that doesn't have the DNA of knowing how to kill seats and get the best out of merchandising and all of that sort of stuff, but they're going to take a piece of it, so you're still going to have to pay people, like the merchandisers and the promoters on top of it. It's not going to be a great deal for these people. Now, when you look at the traditional accounting system and payment, no one's going platinum anymore. And we're in the singles business. Even if you are paying for it, the album is usually 10 songs. You get credit for a single. What we're looking at is, you know, people get upset when I say, but music's free. It is. So, you know, internationally, a lot of people that we want to stoke and continue to drive and get mind share, we just want the music out there. So when you're looking at the encroachment of Spotify, RDO, Moog, all these streaming services, it's only going to get even crazier as far as the river of pennies or fractions of pennies. So why not just get the music out there in the hands of the people that would want them, and then try to monetize it another way? So that may be Xbox Live. You buy Linkin Park's Avatar for $4. You get, you know, get to change it 3 or 4 times. You get a free song every 2 weeks. You buy a Ustream app for Counting Crows, and every Friday night you get a live acoustic version or whatever. So I'm trying to look at our customers now as on an ARPU basis, an average revenue per user over the course of a year, and how much we would have to spend to get that person. And that may mean that someone may get rid of the album. And that may mean that they have to release 40 pieces of content a year, but maybe they make $127 per user. It costs us $32 to get that person, and that's going to be requiring apps. That's where the mobile promise may come into play. E-commerce needs to get their virtual goods is a real big promise, I think, especially in the Asian culture. It's an $8 billion business already. Social games clearly are building. So music, I hate to use the term loss leader, but that may be the marketing tool to get the dollars out of someone's pocket. Slash, we went a different direction with when he came off of his label, when we made a deal with Monster Energy Drink, and basically took part of their marketing budget. They had the ability to put pallets directly into Walmart to circumvent some of the hurdles. Before we got, you know, on 33 million cans, we were able to, they had the music to give away for free for 6 months, and they gave it back to us. They're not in the business of owning IP. And we were able to jumpstart that. And you know, I think you're going to see more and more of that type of stuff. You know, Starbucks has tried to do it, but you know, if you're going to have a record that went platinum after recouping and getting all of that stuff done, and then getting it down, commissions, taxes, and splitting it with four other guys, you're really going to have to go 3 or 4 times platinum before you're even going to get a check. So imagine someone just circumventing that from a sponsorship level, and Jeep saying, here's $2 million in cash, and we just want to borrow your music. There are economic plans that are very, very valuable in the world of advertising. If you look at the world as one big marketplace. And I do think that mobile is going to be the real big jump starter in this space, because that is where people are listening to their music.
Right. So Jeff, what are some of the things that Shazam are doing that, I mean, clearly, you know, Shazam is a large portion of your revenue does come from an ad-supported system. It obviously comes from more of an affiliate-based system. Somebody comes in, they listen to music right away, they get that, it's right away, right at the moment they're listening to it. Something has been recommended to them. They can click on a button, they can purchase it from their choice. What are some of the things that you guys are doing to actually support and build in your product?
Sure.
Things for that artist community.
Yeah.
Things for the and not just for the not just for the not for Aaron's constituency. I'm a very big believer in when you look at mobile and you look at it's local by nature, it's social by nature. I always try to put myself in that more of the working class musician, if you will. I think the promises of mobile is being able to build out a broader working class musicianship, an actual middle class of music. It's very inefficient to get a bunch of guys in a van and drive 500 miles to a gig and then have to do that once a month. That's a largely inefficient system of being able to reach your audience. Being able to reach your audience through things like Shazam
right. Is
a very efficient system. So yes. What are some of the things that you guys do baking into your product to
make that? Sure. So we're doing a lot, and I'll kind of go through a bunch of things quickly here. So for one is we have a dedicated music team that's scouting the web, working with labels, working with independents, monitoring blogs, and making sure we have the latest music in our database. Because we know that as soon as we have that music, that music is taggable and it's discoverable, and from there we can start an experience with that fan. And it may be, you know, a garage band all the way up to Lady Gaga. Whoever it is, we can build an experience for them on mobile when someone tags. And some of the things we're specifically doing today is if that artist has tour dates, we work with a couple different companies to aggregate those. We bring those into that experience. So you tag a song, you see the tour dates. If that artist has a YouTube channel, tag a song, you can see more YouTube videos. In specific cases, we work with Vivo, where we actually launch their app. If that artist has a presence on Vivo, we can start that experience for the user. We also allow sharing, so our app is very social, integration with Facebook and Twitter. You can share that out, and we also launched a feature we call Shazam Friends, which is built off Facebook Connect. So as soon as you connect to Facebook from Shazam, you can see what your Facebook friends are tagging, which is a whole other dimension of discovery right in the app. So your friend may have tagged a brand new band here at South by Southwest. Maybe they heard something playing in one of the venues. Not live, of course. We're not doing that today, but pre-recorded music. And all of a sudden, you know, all your friends on Facebook that are using Shazam can see that band and get right to that tag and start streaming that song on their phone. So that's the kind of experience we're building. The other thing I want to add is, you know, we view ourselves and we're positioning ourselves as an enabler. So whatever your favorite music service of choice happens to be, we just want to get you there. Whether it's buy that track on iTunes, spawn a Spotify streaming station, Last.fm, Pandora, we've done integrations with all of them. And we want to kind of sit in between, you know, that point of inspiration, we call it, when you hear that song, you don't know what it is, and we tell you what it is, and then you can kind of go off and do what you want. Buy it, stream it, experience a video around it, you know, view tour dates, et cetera.
So, John, I think one of the things that has definitely evolved out of the digital music distribution system is that there is a very large group of consumers who are not necessarily focused on owning music any longer. They just want to have access to music. They want to be able to have their environment, their respective library they built, whatever personalization that they do, they just want the access. The concept of physically owning something is becoming more and more amorphous. Maybe talk a little bit about that. Tell me some of the things that specifically with Move Music, what you guys have found to be that way in terms of, I think Move largely, among other things, is a great value add to a carrier service where they recognize music as a legitimate social currency that's going to get people retaining their music carrier service. Tell me maybe some of the things that you've found and consumer behavior specifically that you've found, usage behavior,
Yeah. Customer
segments.
So a few things on the consumer. I think the first thing is getting them engaged, and that really has been a struggle, I think, for a lot of music services. Move today, we have an average of about 40 hours per user per month. and that's across our 500,000 subscribers. So we have enormous engagement. Actually, our download average among the 500,000 is 300 songs per month. So unbelievable engagement. And we were able to do that by making the acquisition process very, very simple. When a user goes into one of Cricut's thousands of their distribution doors, from Best Buy to Walmart to a Cricut store, they go and they buy the phone, and then they sign up for the Cricut wireless rate plan, which includes voice, messaging, data, and music. And when they turn their phone on, they launch Move, and they start downloading. And it's all included in your rate plan, so there's no limits. So very, very seamless process. So that gets them engaged quickly. When you think of the barriers of other services, you've got to go find the app in the App Store and download it and create an account and register a credit card and all those steps, you lose the mass market. But by having that kind of integration, you get people engaged very, very quickly. On the subject of ownership, we specifically made Move Music a download service, not streaming. And there's a big difference there, actually, in the customer perception. I think generally the idea of a stream is that it's free. You know, Pandora and YouTube and others have kind of trained us that streaming music is traditionally a free service, but iTunes has trained us all that downloads cost you 99 cents. And so by having our services download, literally picking the song, hitting the download button, and putting it resident on your phone, there is a perception there that, hey, wait, I didn't have to pay 99 cents for this. It's very, very powerful there. And so that gives them a sense of ownership. But Move Music, the way it works is, if as long as you're paying your rate plan, you have access to the catalog, you can download as much as you want, and you can play your music on the phone. As soon as you stop paying that bill, nothing works. You can't make phone calls, you can't send text messages, can't surf the web, and you can't play your music. And so while we get, in one sense, give the user a sense of ownership, because it's downloaded on their phone and it's resident and it works without an internet connection, it'll work in your basement, for example, they understand that, hey, I'm getting this with my voice and data rate plan, and you all know, you've all been conditioned, as soon as you don't pay that bill, your service won't work. And so by coupling the music with the music, or coupling the music with the data, with the voice, has really, something's happened. We've kind of broken a barrier, a psychological barrier there. Because, you know, initially with the product design, we were really worried that people were going to say, can I own my music? I want to own the music. But, 500,000 subs in and a 90% satisfaction rate, we're learning that it's not about ownership. It is about a great experience, a convenient experience, and a great value. And it's no longer about, I want to have this 10 years from now.
Mike, if I can just comment on that, one of my concerns with that model is, I, as an artist, I don't like to be jammed someone needs to make phone calls, someone needs to make text messages, someone is going to be threatened not to get my artist's music and not get these other services. So I want the music to be ubiquitous. I want it to be not, if they don't pay their bill 1 month, have it disappear. And that comes back on the artist. There's when Warner Music Group had a spat with YouTube and decided to pull all of their stuff off of YouTube, we would get hateful messages. You pulled my music from my wedding. You ruined my video. Or whatever. They don't associate the experience with the business model. They associate it with the emotional attachment to the band or the artist. So that's a real tricky situation. And talking to MSOs, cable providers, they're looking to potentially also provide some of these services as well. They're looking at it as a value add to bundle into their cable bill. But what if you're a Time Warner subscriber versus DirecTV?
Right.
Does that mean you can get? And so that's a real concern on the user level. So what do? They turn around and go to a BitTorrent site.
Right.
And that's what we experience, and that's what I ultimately, and so what requires, what we have to do then is, without the traditional support of record labels, to build the social networks. And we have to know exactly who those consumers are. Shazam is very, very helpful in that process because we know who they are, where they're going, we know what their habits are. But frankly, turning that conversion into a sale after 99 cents, Apple takes its 30% and this and that, whatever, I don't care.
And I think that's where it's important. I mean, certainly if I'm coming from the lens of an artist or just the lens of somebody who owns the content, that you need to have a blending. The ad-supported system, you know, being able to generate ads gives you that flexibility. Your music's never going to get turned off. You always have access to the music. Now, of course, there's rubs there as well, right? You want to make sure that the ads that are flowing through are actually consistent with whatever type of messaging or whatever type of marketing that the content owner wants to propagate. You need to make sure that there's affinity there. But the best practices from an ad-supported model are just that. The winner in this way, in terms of certainly ad-supported, is always going to be more scalable. That's been proven through and through. It's nothing new. You have your paid-for models. You have your ad-supported models. The ad-supported model on an ARPU or on an RPM basis are going to probably be lesser than that of a subscription model, but it's going to be much, much greater in scale and volume. And so it's incumbent on us, the people who are actually providing those ad-supported models, to get it right. To get it right through the lens of the consumer. How are we delivering an ad that's contextual, that's relevant, that's contiguous with what you're doing and adding? It's actually a virtuous cycle that's working with whatever content it's flowing through. When you start adding in things like rich media, which we were talking about earlier, Aaron, you start adding in rich media, you start adding in geo-targeting, you start adding in a tablet experience. Suddenly mobile gets very, very interesting from a monetization perspective. These are things that most folks can relate to. These are things that most folks are already used to ingesting. And the economics and the monetization on that ARPU basis are much, much higher. So I think that it's really important as an industry that we embrace as many of these models as possible. Certainly John's model has its place, Shazam as an enabler, us as an ad-supported medium. These things as a whole are what are going to give us the lift overall.
But the one thing, though, that I think is important, and to the point that Aaron was just making, and what we see from the record company and music publisher point of view, is that the ad-supported models, the greatest challenge with ad-supported models is that there's not enough money in them. That for video, it's one thing because video is a medium that has traditionally not been a transactional model for music. Historically, no one has bought music videos. Very few people. In fact, even today on iTunes, very few people are buying music videos. The challenge with music, with a Spotify-type ad-supported service, or other similar services. People say the same about Pandora, and Pandora has generated significant revenue because of their scale, and their scale is tremendous. But the one challenge and Pandora is really radio-like. It's not on-demand music that directly replaces the purchase experience. The thing that is, I think, important to recognize is that you hear from the artist community that there's not enough money in the Spotify-type models and the Rhapsody-type models. The reason is because they haven't achieved scale yet. And one of the things, for example, what Move is doing and what services that the labels are very interested in and the publishers as well is bundling. And it's really a fourth model. You know, the way I see, there are four core business models for music today. One is a la carte, like iTunes. The second is ad-supported. The third is subscription, and then the fourth is bundle. And the thing, what John has described and what Cricket has done with the Move service is created a model that feels free to the consumer, where you don't feel like you're taking out your credit card every month and charging to get music, but you are paying for it. And the thing with this type of a model is it allows you to tremendously reduce the amount that you're paying as the consumer, because there can be breakage and the labels and publishers are willing to take that into account in terms of what the monthly wholesale price is. And the idea, the goal is to really drive scale. And so I think the real promise in terms of transactional models that are not ad supported is really in the bundled model. And it's one that the industry has been seeking for years, you know, the idea of bundling music with an ISP plan or with a mobile data plan or rate plan. And we're just beginning to see that emerge. And I think there's a tremendous promise with that.
I think that there's a fifth model there that it's hit and miss, but direct to consumer. And so what we have done is spend an enormous amount of time to build the social communities and use these third-party services to get access to who the consumers are. It obviously informs us who the fans are. Oftentimes it's counterintuitive to what you think, but you can put together high-margin items, as you know, a signed skateboard deck along with the album first and whatever, where you capture that super fan, that, you know, 5 to 10% or whatever, where your margins are $55 to $75 a pop. Now you're looking at, you know, who's controlling your future. You've got Facebook, which is somewhat neutral. You've got Amazon, which does have the ability to ship physical goods, although they're not right now, but they could. Yeah. Apple, which doesn't, and Google, which is generally pretty hostile towards content providers, or rather, they don't share their plans. So the do it yourself. So, you know, the top spends the, you know, a lot of the merchandising companies are trying to solve this stuff. Could you get a limited edition T-shirt 2 weeks, and then the second the single drops, it's out of business, it's out of order, whatever. The idea that if you just sold 10,000 high-priced items, you could gross as much as, you know, a million, yeah, you know, whatever. So that plan, you know, D2C needs it's also at its infancy, but I think it holds a lot of promise.
Right. And mobile certainly is an obvious carrier for that.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I was going to add to that we're actively working on that at Shazam, building and, you know, obviously can't share detail, but I can tell you that, you know, we see a real need for you know, merchandising and selling things related to the artists. Obviously, you know, in conjunction with the management teams of those artists, direct to consumer, when they're inspired by that artist, tagging them for the first time or hearing them again and wanting to buy something immediately. Obviously, there's a lot of work to be done to make buying on mobile better. It's not great today, and we're working on that though.
So yeah, go ahead.
Just one more. I want to make a point on the bundled model that Bobby talked about. The you know, Cricket serves a unique customer segment, about, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's a younger demographic, lower income, more ethnic, and this is a segment that, and it's a large segment in the United States that has not really been monetizable in the digital music space. These are folks who've had low to no ARPU for artists. So, you know, the model, while new and maybe not perfect yet, but I think when we think about who we're bringing people in, who now have actually a great ARPU, a very high ARPU. So taking a segment who is paying nothing to now a large segment that is actually getting artists paid, I think is a pretty powerful thing.
I just want to clarify that that's a great business if you own a catalog. As an individual artist, someone, you know, there are several artists we represent that have sold well over 50 million units in their career, albums at, you know, your $13 price point or, you know, whatever, that wouldn't make a dent. We'd get checks for $100 being part of these bundles, and we've gone down the road and done some due diligence on some of this stuff. But if you owned a catalog, Warner Music Group or Universal could make a fortune off of it.
You have lots of bundle providers that in mass you start generating a lot more revenue.
Well, that would require a very clear, it goes back to what was stated at the beginning, a trust and a very clear accounting system, and everybody has a different one. Everybody has every country. Sometimes it's okay to upload, sometimes it's okay to download. Germany is always a pain in the butt. You know, you've got some pretty, you know, no one wants to you know, do business in Russia or China. And, you know, those are all issues. But let's just say it was part of your cable bill. That would be great, you know. But it would be great for Pandora. And it would be great for Spotify. But I don't know that it would be great for Green Day, which is a massive, or Metallica. There just isn't, you can't play it enough for those fractions of pennies to actually make sense.
Right? See, I think one of the things that is interesting, because, I mean, you can see from the comments that Aaron is making versus what John and I were talking about, is there is definitely, on the one hand, there's the question of what makes sense to you if you're an artist who has a brand already and has a following and can reach your audience. I mean, obviously, the lion's share of artists don't have that. And the lion's share of artists need the types of services that are going to put them in front of a mass audience. And I think that it's true that there is this dilemma. And, you know, frankly, you see it even with the major labels. You see it with, you know, EMI, where they have an artist like Coldplay that pulls out of Spotify, or Adele in the case of Sony. And one of the challenges that you have is that for most services to work, if the industry is looking to monetize music and to create an offer that is compelling in light of the fact that, Archie, as you noted, that most people are downloading things or streaming without paying for it, the only way to create a compelling model is to have ubiquity. If you don't have ubiquity, the minute that the fan goes and finds that the music they want is not there and they're paying for it, they're going to wonder why they're paying for it. Right. And so for services like iTunes, like Spotify, like Rhapsody, like Move, you need to have everything. And so there's this dilemma between the artist who may look at some of these services and say, I'm not making that much, other than with a la carte, because with a la carte, you know, it's much, you know, and the artist can monetize in exactly the way they want to. But in the new services, and I think most agree that the a la carte transactional model is not one that's likely to survive 10 years from now. Whether that will even exist is a big question mark. It definitely is this dilemma, because when you have these services, what happens is that the superstar artists end up being diluted by the mass of other artists who are also sharing in the revenue pool that's divided up among all users.
Right. So we're going to get into Q&A in here in a minute, but I don't want folks leaving the table until, and Jeff, we'll start with you. Just want to give everyone a sense of what you think is really, really interesting, really disruptive, really intriguing coming down the line specific to mobile and music. Things that you've been seeing also in terms of your own, you know, the users in your ecosystem, mm-hmm. Maybe some things that are really interesting to you that you hadn't thought of before, but you, clearly the numbers speak for themselves, and maybe just a few things that you think are going to be real trendsetters or real disruptors over the next, say, 12 to 18 months.
Sure. There are many of them, so I'll just talk through a few. So one interesting one that you know we're looking at, and obviously the artists are very, very involved with, is kind of, you know, live music and the experience around that. And to kind of echo the direct to consumer piece, you know, you're an artist, you're playing. How do you build a better experience at that point in time at that venue with those fans? You know, whether it's selling them stuff, giving them additional content, unlocking stuff for them, giving them exclusive access to things, and all that can be powered on mobile devices. Yeah. At the venue or even after the fact. You know, we know you just attended something, now we can offer you more. So that's very interesting, and I think that's going to be highly disruptive, because it's going to bring, you know, merchandising and that artist-to-fan relationship to a whole new level. You can have the super fan of that show doing things in that, you know, in the crowd or later online and sharing that experience online through things like Shazam and other mobile apps. So I think, and it's already happening, but I think it's going to get even more interesting. And then the other thing just to note on is you know, we're in 200 countries today, and I think last time I checked, iTunes is in 50 maybe.
Yeah.
And they launched about 25 in the past 12 to 14 months. So that just goes to show that the commerce piece is catching up. In globally, but it's not, you know, it's not essentially global today. And so that's, you know, I think that's obviously exciting, and it's a challenge at the moment.
Right. And Aaron, what, through the lens of the of your artists and your clients, what are you guys really excited about mobile? And from what you've been seeing and from the artist's perspective, what are the things that you're really bullish on, and what do you think is going to be a critical disruptor in the next, say, 12 to 24 months?
Well, I I was going to say and parrot what Jeff just said, but just to clarify that, being able to socially meet people online, maybe do some sort of a leaderboard thing, social currency, and then get a badge, that's the only way you can meet the band inside the venue. Major League Baseball has done some pretty great stuff as far as, you know, when you click it, see all of your friends that are in there, or meet up with two or three of them, get the 25 limited edition t-shirts. In the meantime, we're mining that data to be able to use for, you know, when we're looking at career, we're looking at 20, 30 years. And, you know, anybody says they know what's going on after 6 months is just, you should just walk the other direction. You know, whatever it is, you know, it's not going to happen. So that's one. But two, I'll state that I really do believe that the way to monetize in some of these areas like Southeast Asia and stuff like that is through the live, and also eventually through gaming and virtual currency, virtual goods. And so whoever figures that out with Facebook credits or however that is, I think that music will come along with power-up packages and whatever else that will go along with social and console gaming.
And Bobby, from the man who is who's at the forefront of how these deals are being carved out, and you certainly get to see the mindset of the copyright owners, the artists, and for that matter, the people who are trying from a technology perspective to solve some of the pain points of a better consumer experience. What do you think, where is your prescient sense of what you think is going to be successful in mobile? And then what are some of the things that you think, just in your own personal set, that would be really disruptive and very innovative to propagate music in mobile?
Well, you know, to some of the things we've been talking about, I think that bundled models are clearly going to be a very significant force over the next several years. I think that that right now, one of the challenges to growth that a company like a Spotify or others that are subscription-oriented have is that they target the true music user who realizes the value in a pull model where the user knows exactly what he or she wants to find, but it's not entirely clear how that model is suited for the mainstream and the masses. And so a lot of these services, I mean, John mentioned Rhapsody that has achieved about 1 million users over 11 years.
Right.
And the question is, how do you get beyond that into the mainstream? So I think that bundled models will help with that, because it's going to introduce a new segment, the same way that Sirius and XM have in the automobile field by bundling. You know, through, you know, you buy a car and you get a year subscription and expose people to what that service is all about. So I think that's one thing that's very promising. The other thing that I think that is interesting and I think will also be very important for mobility, we haven't really talked much about, are locker services, cloud. Where, because what's happening is we're entering a world where people's assets are entirely digital, and people's music collections are entirely digital. And storage is at a premium because, number one, you want to make sure that you don't lose everything and it's backed up sufficiently. But secondly, the quality of files are increasing. You're going to see more and more of that. There are new technologies, a company we're working with that is looking to sell master audio quality files that are actually 5 times the resolution of CDs. But all of these things take up storage. And so the idea of lockers where you can store music somewhere but access it anywhere, I think you're going to see that being a very important part of mobile, because you're going to continuously have less room on your handset than you're able to use, you know, in terms of allocating for music content.
And just being able to have anywhere, anytime, any place, even if you have disparate systems, whether it's iTunes or Sonus or whatever it may be, the systems that you work in the house, to be able to have that in one system on your mobile would be compelling.
That's right.
And from your lens, from kind of where we're at on this, I know that a lot of the stuff you're keeping is on the subscription bead, but there's so much more to what you guys have to think about it from work, especially being attached at the hip with a carrier. What are some of the things that you think are going to be disruptive, and what are some learnings that you've had that you guys are really working on building and exploiting over the next 12 to 18 months in mobile?
I think there's going to be a convergence in digital music. There is an explosion of innovation out there. There's all kinds of great apps, not necessarily digital music services, but Well, I think Shazam is a prime example. There's just dozens and dozens of apps coming out on mobile, but they don't have audiences. They're not integrated well with other music services. So I think you're going to start to see some of these innovations start merging with the right partners, and you'll start seeing that innovation come through to real audiences, something like Move has today. I think the other thing is global expansion. You know, the cost of mobile phones is coming down. Android is taking over the world, and there are billions of mobile users out there that are going to be on Android. And so the door to the global opportunity and the mass market, I think, is opening right now. And I think we're going to see that. I think, you know, we talked about this model not having scale yet. I think we'll see it with the international opportunity.
Cool. And on that, we will open it up to Q&A. There's a microphone right over there. I would jump out behind the table and give it to you, but I'm too lazy. So go ahead and pop on over. We're getting you tech support.
I guess I was hoping to get an example. Maybe this is more for you, Aaron. You had mentioned the promotion with the Monster drink and Slash, and you know, the first thing that came to mind is like, wow, that it's amazing to have someone on all those cans and it's in all these stores. Was there something cool with mobile there? Was there a check-in reward when people checked into Walmart? Did they get something later? Did you get that data where, you know, you have such a big fan base, but it goes back like 30 years. So it would be great to kind of micro target these people that are using Foursquare. And so I guess, have you done anything like that? And has Foursquare been good about giving that information back, because they're growing so rapidly and people, like you said, everything changes in 6 months. People are using Foursquare today for a lot of different reasons than they were using 6 months ago, which, you know, discounting and all this stuff. It used to be about points, and now it's about how do I get rewarded for showing up somewhere. So mm-hmm. If you had an example, that would be...
Well, the first question you asked, no, we didn't, because the technology wasn't available at the time. If we were to do it again, that would be our number one goal, would be to collect that data. Monster's goal is to move as much in the mass market so that they can prove that they get better shelf space in their secondary 7-Eleven market. So we would just try to help them get better data as well. Last year, we launched the first music Foursquare badge with Big Boy, and frankly, we haven't seen a lot of stickiness with that. It's hard to, like you said, people are expecting some sort of a value. I've checked in, what do I get? what we were describing about earlier, at a live show, if you were to get the badge, and Foursquare is much more mass than this, but if you got the badge for Kelly Rowland, who's a client of ours, for example, and you got it off the X Factor, and we were partnered with Shazam or whatever it may be, once you're in the venue, all of a sudden you can see everyone else who checked in through the X Factor. If you meet up with three or four of them and you get a special badge, then you get access to meet the band or get a better seat or something like that, find your friends. So today, that's the technology that we're working on to help with the live experience, and also just to see, you know, help you sit with your friends and stuff like that. But some of the deals that we're working on right now with brands, we are absolutely looking at location-based services.
Do you feel like the brand is the key to kind of making the Foursquare component stickier?
We got to look at the brand as a strategic standpoint. So if you have distribution Starbucks, obviously there's a brand there. Hot Topic, there's a brand there. So Slash might make sense for Hot Topic, or Godsmack might, or whatever it may be. We really get behind the scenes with them. But the powerful tool that they don't control, that they want to, that which they'll barter out with information, is they don't have a presence in the live show. So if Hot Topic can be involved in that. Now, there are complications because of the merchandiser and stuff like that, but these are all things that are being worked out. The real power is in the live show.
Yep.
Anyone else? Questions?
I can chime in on one more.
Okay.
One more thought there. So we're looking at it from a TV perspective. So if a brand is, you know, launching a major TV campaign, spending millions of dollars, they want that engagement. And the brands that are working with the bands to create, you know, a great TV spot, I unfortunately can't talk about specifics coming up, but I can tell you there are a couple TV ads coming up that will be featuring major bands with major brands, and you know, we can build an experience around that for both. That benefits the brand and the band. It could be, you know, exclusive content for the band regarding that band, and the deeper engagement for the brand to go on and learn more about the product and potentially get a coupon on your mobile device. So I think you're going to see a whole lot more of that happening. And mobile will lead that charge.
And the monetization of that goes direct to the artist in that particular case.
In that particular...
You're doing deals directly with the artist. And,
in some cases, yes.
Right.
In some cases, it's pure marketing for the artist. The artist wants to get something exclusive out to a fan base.
Yeah.
And some of it's discovery. I mean, best example is the Chevy ad that ran with the band Fun right before the Super Bowl. And, you know, I personally, and I'm sure many in the room hadn't heard of them before, and they kind of came up within 5 to 6 weeks, hit number one on Shazam. And to get number one on Shazam, I mean, it's thousands of tags a day.
Right.
And, you know, that's just one example of how we can help break a band that's associated with a TV ad or a specific brand.
Right. I just want to throw something in very quickly about why there's distrust with the record labels. These deals go down oftentimes without the consent of the artist, and oftentimes after bands have broken up or whatever, and it's catalog, yet they have no control over it and they get no money from it. So they can go make the deal with Shazam because that's their right. But you know, that doesn't bode well for the relationship.
Just equally egregiously, they never see any revenue from it.
Absolutely.
The label will leverage the name of the band.
Absolutely.
And to your point, leverage it on a video that the band plays for.
That's right.
And still not see a penny of the revenue generated from that.
That's right.
I'm just curious about something. It seems like there are two ways we're talking about monetizing creative work from an artist. One, I buy it, I listen to it, sort of my direct consuming of the music. And the other is to sell stuff. And I'm just wondering, in terms of where most of the money is found, is it in the use of music in conjunction with the sponsorship and branding opportunities you were just talking about? Or is it in the consumer, me just buying it to listen to it?
So it depends on whose pocket it's going into. The artist, and Aaron, you can keep me honest here, I mean, the artist is generating their revenue predominantly off of live music,
and
by and large.
Yeah.
That's the bullet. Where, of course, the record labels and the publishers are generating the use of that, the actual copyright of that. But if you are you asking which is the overall, which makes
yeah, I'm just curious if you have some idea of the ratio, looking at it from, never mind for the moment whose pocket it goes into,
yeah.
but relative percentages of where money's getting spent. Is it on that, you know, me as a consumer buying music so I can listen to it, or is it using music to sell stuff, whether it's in a movie or in a commercial or some sort of special sponsorship arrangement?
Right now, let's say, you know, you were in the next Superman movie or whatever. You could easily get $1 million check and plus royalties that goes out on DVD. That's, you know, that could be around forever, and you get publishing off that, whatever. To make that type of a revenue based off of your 12 cents off of iTunes or whatever it may be ain't going to happen. I don't think Coldplay even went platinum when they were off Spotify until at a certain point. I don't know if they still have, but I know company bands like Green Day and stuff like that, it took over a year to generate that type of sales volume, which does not translate into a clean $1 million.
And when you look at how you are going to best exploit a particular composition, let's say, are there different types of music that do better on the I'm going to buy it and listen to it scale versus the sort of, you know, sponsorship or you know, sort of licensing kind of scale? Is there one type of music that does better in one arena?
Well, right now, just to be, you know, honest, the your top 16 songs, whatever, it's urban and pop, pop rock is on the down slide, but urban and pop don't necessarily have the audience, and they very rarely have merchandise because they're hipped up, they're trying to represent the street or whatever it may be, wearing football jerseys and stuff like that. And they're not necessarily building a touring base. Record labels are getting paid off of that single, so they're pushing the single, not necessarily the artist. And but we are seeing the format of rock going away. At the same time, we're starting to see the rise of electronic dance music, which is more of a live experience, and people are feeling they're getting more for their money, and that is not on radio yet. So... But that's probably where people are spending the most of their money, along with other festivals like Coachella and stuff like that.
Thanks.
You mentioned Rich Media with regards to advertising a few times. We're a Rich Media startup learning about the space. What are you seeing that's interesting and captivating, and what do you see that's not working with regards to mobile and advertising and Rich Media?
I just say one thing, because I know I don't want to hog this, but it was you guys, and it was really, really cool. I was looking at an ad for True Blood, and I pushed it on my iPhone, and it left a bloody fingerprint, and all of a sudden blood came down it, and I was like, this is really, really cool, and it really stuck in my mind. I probably sent it to 50 people. That was really cool. I thought it was so unexpected.
So Aaron answered the question to some extent. I mean, best practices for Rich Media are being able to have an ad unit that is really engaging and gets people involved in whatever the messaging you is. And I know that's kind of vague and nebulous. You can then take that a layer down, and you want to basically use what mobile delivers well. So mobile should be delivering targeting well, so you should be having some kind of geo or some kind of location thing that you can base that into and make sure that the creative and the rich is matching that. If you can target by audience, being able to make sure that the rich media environment that you're doing is going to be germane and relevant to the audience that you're reaching out to. It's a really, really sloppy, screwed up system right now. Mobile is massively fragmented, as you probably are aware. So you have complete lack of communication amongst operating systems from a network perspective. The ad slot sizes, the actual real estate where an ad's going to show up on a particular piece of content, is not particularly unified. We do not have a kind of a codified rules of the road as that goes, so it's kind of the wild, wild west. In some ways, that's really cool for someone like you. That means that you get to be innovative. That means you get to define what the rules are going to be, because there will be rules and they will get established, but I think we're still probably 2 years out from having that be on a really scale basis. We at Mobi were huge believers in Rich Media. We think that that is you have to have that. You have the consumer, you have the publisher, you have the advertiser. It literally goes in that order. And so we purchased a company called Sprout, which is a leader in rich media production. So we're very, very bullish, very big believers in rich media. The best thing I can tell you is just do exactly what Aaron listed. And that's a prime example. It's completely relevant to the thing that you're marketing. It's going to capture somebody's attention. It's going to get somebody engaged and involved. We have metrics like click-through rates and engagement times and conversion rates. And these are all the metrics that you're really boring, stale metrics that you hear within the ad network business. Rich media is a driver of that. The more you increase that, that means you're increasing your revenue. It means you're increasing your monetization. Aaron becomes happy. If we're having an ad-supported system within the record labels, they become happy. The whole constituency becomes happy when you're able to lift that monetization. Rich media is the prime driver for that. Video is loosely, broadly defined as rich media as well. We're very bullish on video. Video is going to be a very critical driver. Why? Because to what Aaron had raised earlier about a 30-second spot, television spot, that is still the ad lingua franca, if you will. That is the ad medium that everyone gravitates towards. 70% of that inventory is sold in upfronts in 1 week. It's worth billions and billions of dollars. That is still where the majority of commerce, even over the internet still doesn't hit a blip comparatively to broadcast advertising. So being able to take those assets, repurpose them into a mobile strata, or repurpose them into a digital strata and generate the revenue off of that's going to be very, very disruptive. So make sure that your rich media that you put together, look at all the various factors and make sure that that particular creative unit is matching the geo, is matching the audience, is matching the consumer. Okay, I'm getting the cane coming up and pulling me off on the neck. Thanks a lot, guys. I know it was kind of a pain in the ass because you went from one venue and you had to come to another, and I think I said ass in a church. I'm sorry. But at any rate, thanks for having us. Appreciate it.